SRNU.
Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and streaming on the web at
kcbq.com.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder where God is when people do evil. Well, I have a better question. Where are people when people do evil? Yes, we had another horrible suicide shooting in Bimington, New York. My heart goes out to the families. I can imagine nothing more tragic and pointless. I do have one question, however. How will they blame this one on George Bush? He isn't in office anymore. Oh, wait, I've got it. The economy may be bad under Obama, but he inherited it from Bush. That's why this poor misdirected kid got laid off from work. That's why he shot all those people. Oh, that George Bush, he's done it again. I'm really mad this time. Of course, to come to a conclusion like that these days, where you blame everyone but the person who committed the crime, you'd have to go to college. Thinking of sending your kid to college? Wondering how to pull it off with our failing economy? Well, take a big sigh of relief. Your old pal Bob is going to carry the day. It's quite simple, really. Instead of paying $30,000 a year for tuition, just teach your offspring the following talking points, and they will have the equivalent of an undergraduate degree. Heck, they'll even have the equivalent of a master's degree. Here we go. First, everything about America is evil. In fact, all countries from Western civilization are evil, but none are worse than America. On the other hand, all countries that are not a part of Western civilization are good and pure, with the exception of Israel. All religions are good and pure, except Christianity. We should learn to respect all religions, except Christianity. All white people are racists. Those who do not admit to being a racist are especially racist. People of color can never be called racist, even if they say racist things. This is because they do not have the power. All men are pigs, with the exception of homosexual males and male people of color. All rich people are evil, except Democratic politicians, George Soros, Michael Moore, and any left-wing Hollywood celebrity. Well, that pretty much covers it. Maybe you don't agree with those points, but why should that matter? If you share them with your children, they will be as educated as any college student. And hey, I didn't even charge you. Of course, it may not matter anymore. Soon, nothing may matter. Why? Because North Korea finally made good on its threat and fired a test missile, despite the fact that Bill Clinton wrote them a check years ago in exchange for a promise to cease hostilities. Before firing the rocket, Kim Jong-il warned that any attempt on the part of America to disable this rocket will be considered a declaration of war. And how did the Obama administration respond to the latest chapter of history in the making? Well, last week they promised that the launching pad itself would not be taken out. And supposing they fire the rocket and it seems to be headed for the West Coast, they were asked, will we then take the missile out? Will we shoot it down in midair? Well, maybe. But even for that scenario, we did not get a clear answer from the administration of change. Instead, our gallant Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, wife of Daddy Warbucks, who thought he had paid off Kim Jong-il, did indeed promise firm action if a nuclear rocket was fired. She said there will be a stiff reprimand from the United Nations. Jump. Ben Jiminy, did you hear the rumblings from North Korea last week, even before the rumbling of the missile itself? That was the sound of Kim Jong-il shaking in his sleep. Then, this morning, after North Korea fired its missile, President Obama condemned the action as a violation of UN resolutions and said words must have consequences. But only last week, this same President Obama apologized to Europe for the arrogance of America, an arrogance which takes action apart from Europe. Which action was he referring to? Among other things, the action of going to war with Iraq, an action he has criticized many times, an action taken by George Bush apart from the help of France, Germany, and Russia, who had agreed to the United Nations condemnations, but they were all caught making under-the-table deals with Iraq. And what was Bush's reasoning? Because, again, it seems Iraq had violated 16 UN resolutions, and Bush felt that words must have consequences. Same thing Obama is saying now. Speaking of blowing up the earth, let's see where we are so far in the war against terror. For one thing, the Obama administration has decided to stop calling it that. The new title is The War Against Man-Made Disasters. I like that. The War Against Man-Made Disasters. I can only guess the reasons for this new marketing ploy. If we can make the crisis sound no different than global warming, then Obama cannot be blamed when he views climate change as an even greater crisis. How can we accuse him of failing to protect us when he spends so much time passing green legislation? Another reason seems to be that of toning down the provocative rhetoric. After all, we don't want to sound like that tough-talking cowboy George Bush. This fits in well with those new diplomatic talks going on in Iran, the first in years. The fancy verbiage also coincides with Hillary's offer to bring the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to the table for talks, if only they will renounce their violence. Just one question. I always like to ask simple questions. If such a strategy is really the right approach, if terrorists are not going to view the latest policy as a sign of weakness, like terrorist experts tell us they will, if instead they are bound to change their tune in response to us acting more friendly, then how come the Taliban only days ago informed our country to expect a major attack against Washington, D.C.? How could this be? Is it possible that evil really does exist? Will evil continue to be evil simply because it wants to, despite the soothing message of change? I guess we should cut Obama some slack. After all, he and his buddies have been pretty busy lately trying to save the economy. They can't be bothered by little things like bombs or nuclear fallout. Now our government is seeking to take control even over businesses that are not asking them for money. It's the truth. Last week, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner asked Congress to give the White House power to seize large insurance companies and investment firms. When Republican Representative Michelle Brockman asked where the Constitution allowed the government such power, Geithner looked rather confused. Maybe he'd never heard of the Constitution, or perhaps he had heard of it, but was under the impression that Obama had already succeeded in destroying the Constitution in only 2 months instead of the originally projected 3 months. I'm glad to hear that modern-day versions of the Boston Tea Party are going on all over the country. This gives me hope. It also makes me feel melancholy. I cannot help but think about the framers of our Constitution, Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, and the like. I compare these names to other names, Geithner, Pelosi, Reed, Obama. Gives you a chill, doesn't it? Trusted with the sacred task of running the most wonderful country to ever grace the pages of history and guarding the freedoms put in place by our forefathers, the 2009 team seems to care little about freedom. Are we free to drive the kinds of cars we want, or do we have to worry about emission standards? Are we free to make money, or will our money be redistributed? Are we free to protect our borders, or will we be called bigots for even suggesting such a thing? Are we free to educate our children in a way we see fit, or will we have to deal with those who want to close down homeschools because they don't offer sensitivity training? Are we free to talk about God, or do we need to fear the ACLU? Heck, are we free to speak what we want about any subject? Or must we be aware of hate speech? Legislation which silences alternative viewpoints in the name of tolerance? Are we free to listen to the kind of radio we wish, or will we be contending with the fairness doctrine? And just recently it came to my attention that Obama plans to get his hands on the internet, and perhaps they're going to start censoring that too. After the fairness doctrine and talk radio, what the heck is left? Are we free to eat the kinds of foods we want, or do we need to deal with PETA and other special interest groups? Will doctors be free to help all people, or will the government tell them to refrain from helping the elderly? Is this the America of Jefferson and Adams? Is it even the America of Bob Dylan? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, give us a call, 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. We also take email questions, and we'll get to some of them when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
On 1170 KCBQ Intelligent Talk Radio, what else could it be? Here's a question on this program whose theme is Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. I get this question quite a bit, actually. Bob, are Christians really commanded to give 10% of their income in the church? My pastor says this is an important financial stewardship standard of God called tithing. Well, I'm glad I accidentally said my Bible, because that really is the question. Is the Bible commanding this, or are just a lot of pastors commanding it? Of course, when pastors command it, they say they're getting it from the Bible. And since they've been to seminary, and since they've been ordained, and since they've been licensed, sometimes people assume that whatever their pastor tells them is true. It's true that in the Old Testament, if we want to look at that part of the Bible, under the Mosaic Law, God did command 10% of the animal and agricultural produce of the Israelites. You can read about that in Leviticus 27:30. Under the New Covenant, however, the New Testament, we do not live by laws. Now, we got into this a little bit last week when we were talking about the Sabbath. Similar discussion. We don't live under laws anymore. Instead, the Holy Spirit helps us to make the most unselfish decisions that we can on a case-by-case basis. In Jeremiah, the 31st chapter, it says, "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers, my covenant which they broke when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, even though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it upon their hearts." Now, as I mentioned last week, Jesus has fulfilled the ritual law by his death on the cross and the moral law by his imparting of the Holy Spirit. The Spirit guides us and inspires us to follow the one law God commands people to obey, what we commonly call the Golden Rule, Jesus' words from the Sermon on the Mount that tell us to make loving decisions and consider the feelings of everybody. "In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets," Matthew 7:12. You see, Jesus is offering a condensed view of the law and the prophets. Paul seems to understand this same concept in the 5th chapter of Galatians. Paul writes, "The entire law is summed up in a single command, love your neighbor as yourself." Now, as I mentioned before, when a church tries to single out a command like tithing or a command like the Sabbath that we discussed last week and ask us to continue to honor that command, they open a whole new can of worms. That Paul addressed this can of worms when he wrote the Galatians. The Galatians had isolated circumcision as a practice to continue even under the new covenant. Paul told them that if they were going to return to the law, they must embrace the entire law. They could not cherry pick the ones they wanted and ignore all the others. Galatians 5:2, "Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law." Now you're asking me, but Bob, doesn't the work of God still need finances? Aren't we supposed to support our pastors and missionaries? Yes, we are. It is the legalism, the burden of an exact amount that we are free from. 2 Corinthians 9:7 says, each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. I have heard many a sermon about the blessings that will be withheld if people do not tithe. Call me a romantic, but that sounds like compulsion, and Paul is telling us not to give under compulsion. On the other hand, there's absolutely nothing wrong with picking an amount of your income for consistent giving, and maybe that amount should be 10%. I mean, obviously, God liked the amount. We know that, at least. Or just to avoid being legalistic, you may want to consider giving 9% or 11% and steer clear of the figure 10. The truth is, most churches would not get by, and most pastors would not be able to do ministry full-time if people were not giving 10% and feeling obligated to do so. Therefore, even though I am trying to be theologically honest, I am not eager to see Christians embrace this new freedom with too much enthusiasm. I myself could have made men's eat far more easily when I was a pastor if I had taught tithing in my church, and my current radio ministry could use more money right now. But I still have to be true to what's correct in the Bible. If you have been giving 10% to ministry, let me say this as carefully as I can. If you have been giving 10% to ministry, that is not a bad discipline. As humans, we are creatures of habit. If we do not stick with some kind of constant figure month to month, we will end up making excuses. We will discover that we are seldom, if ever, giving to the church, and that would not be right either. So no, you don't have to give a tenth. You don't have to tithe. But if you already are, I would hate to discourage an admirable impulse. 1-888-344-1170, or if you're shy on the phone and want to send it in by email, like Jim in Alpine, the question is, Bob, can you think of any verses that would allude to an age of accountability besides where Jesus states that the children's angels do always behold the face of the Father and David going to his child that had died? Please let me know. Thanks. Very good question, Jim. Putting aside the blatantly obvious observation that sending a baby to hell does not seem to be the action of a loving God, many Christians believe there is such a thing as the age of accountability. Although that exact term is not found in Scripture, here are a few verses about children not knowing good from evil, and it is implied that God does not hold children responsible for what they do not know. Deuteronomy 1:39, and the little ones that you said would be taken captive, your children who do not yet know good from bad, they will enter the land. And Isaiah 7, but before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. See also Matthew 12, which contains a description of the only sin for which Jesus did not die. This sin is a conscious and final refusal to serve Christ. Since Christ makes himself known today through his Spirit, the sin is appropriately titled blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. Now, it's certainly understandable that one will have honest historical doubts about the person of Jesus, but ignoring the experience of God's drawing Spirit is quite another matter. When Christ, by the Spirit's power, performed a miracle in front of certain Pharisees, they were left without an excuse to admit his true identity. Christ's credibility had been clearly established. Not wanting to knuckle under, the Pharisees quickly attributed the Holy Spirit's work to the power of Satan. This lie is the blasphemy. A more modern person might try to write the Spirit's influence off as some kind of weird, repressive thought, something like that. Now, of course, it's easy to see why a sinful man does not wish to repent, but is it conceivable that a baby who has not even obtained a sense of right and wrong could possibly commit this sin? Of course not. So chill out, people. God's a lot more fair and a lot more loving and a lot more flexible than we give him credit for. Here's a very important, very common question. If God wants to make himself known, why are there so many different religions? Do they each present the same truth in a different fashion? Now, that's a very common idea today, that all religions are right. You realize, of course, when somebody says all religions are right, they mean all religions are wrong. They just haven't thought about it. When they say all religions are right, but you tell the person, but the religions all contradict, they say, well, that doesn't matter. Well, it would matter to them if they thought they were talking about something real. If they all contradict, they can't all possibly be right. But since people just think religion is a comforting fantasy anyway, it's just a matter of individual choice. It doesn't matter whether they contradict. So when they say all religions are right, they mean all religions are wrong. Anyway, it's a very fair question. It is based upon the assumption that religions are basically teaching the same thing. In fact, they are teaching many different things. Once while lecturing at the University of Minnesota, the noted apologist Cliff Konecny was confronted by a student who claimed that all religions were basically the same. Cliff responded that day with a piercing analogy. He said, "If I were to assume that all Chinese people were the same, it would mean one of two things. Either I'm a bigot, or I have not taken the time to study Chinese people. The same is true of different religions." You see, once we realize that all religions are not teaching the same thing, we're forced to confront the religions the same way we would confront any other truth claim. And it would help to start with a key bullet point from the ancient philosopher Aristotle. I'm referring to his law of non-contradiction. This law, foundational to philosophy, states that two given truth claims must not contradict. If they do, at least one of them is wrong, and possibly they are both wrong. In other words, one cannot call his wife on the phone and say, "Sweetie, I'm coming home for dinner, and yet I am not coming home for dinner." Sound simple? It should. We accept this idea without hesitation in every facet of life. Every facet of life except religion, that is. People are usually afraid to test religions out of fear that they will be showing intolerance. It should be noted that one can respect freedom of religion without assuming that all religions are equally valid, because such a conclusion is intellectually dishonest. Now you think, but isn't it closed-minded to claim that Jesus is the only way to God? Well, at the beginning of any kind of inquiry, we should certainly be open to a wide range of possibilities, but sooner or later, everybody closes their minds. We remain open only for a while with the objective of finding what we're looking for, learning new facts, and eventually closing our minds. Whether or not the world rotates around the sun may have been an open question centuries ago, but scientists have long since drawn conclusions, which means scientists have long since closed their minds. I remember once a student at UC Santa Barbara accused me of being closed-minded, insisted that if I had an open mind, I could not possibly believe that there is only one way to God, Jesus. I said to him, "Let me ask you a question. Are you open-minded enough to consider the possibility that there is only one way to God?" "What?" "Well, you say you have an open mind." "All right, then, are you open-minded enough to at least ponder the possibility that Jesus may be the only way?" "Absolutely not." "Oh, really? Well, this is interesting. You can't even consider it?" "Never." "Why can't you?" "Because such a belief is closed-minded." I said, "Yeah, but the consideration of the belief isn't. An open mind says maybe there are 1,000 ways to God. Maybe there are 2 ways to God. Maybe there are no ways to God. Maybe there is only one way to God. That is a truly open mind. We have to do away with this myth that as Christians we arrived at our belief by closing our minds. Indeed, our minds had to be open to consider the claims of Jesus Christ. Now, pointing out that Jesus' teachings are different from other religions is not the same as proving that they're true. People point that out to me all the time, and they're absolutely correct. So let us put forth some objective standards with which we can examine all religions. I will define a religion for the sake of this conversation as an alleged truth about our existence revealed from some type of higher order. These various belief systems should be compared to some expectations, and we'll find out what those expectations are when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
One crucial criterion for judging a religion is that the religion must go hand in hand with our own conscience. We have a conscience that tells us right from wrong, and we cannot be superior to our own creator. Therefore, he not only knows right from wrong, but he programmed right and wrong into our DNA. The resulting conscience tells us how God expects us to live. This means that God will someday somehow hold people accountable for the way they live. Because if he didn't, he would not be a just God, and justice is certainly one quality of goodness. This introduces an immediate problem. I'm referring, of course, to our universal guilt. Since nobody lives a righteous life, our divine judge will have to condemn us all. Or will he? Nobody seems to be able to submit completely to the conscience. People are apparently trapped. Would there be no mercy to the woman who cries for release, or the man? Would there be no hope for the victim who hates his wicked nature and desires change? Mercy is never an obligation, but mercy is still a sophisticated quality found within the imperfect human. And again, would people have a worthy quality that God doesn't have? He's got to be better than us, right? How can a loving God execute justice and mercy at the same time? How might he deliver people from the shackles of their own deadly selfishness? That's not an easy question to answer, but an accurate religion will address the puzzle. Nevertheless, the conscience and its insinuation of justice and mercy does mean we are talking about a loving God. The establishment of a loving God supplies many additional conclusions because there are many things a loving God would do and many things a loving God would not do. We can now test different religions to see if they are indeed talking about a loving God. First of all, if the Creator is loving, the Creator will reveal himself to people. Now, I'm frequently amazed at the typical assumption that God would be doing something out of the ordinary by speaking with his own creation. Certainly, God is capable of communication. Otherwise, we would not be capable either. Is it conceivable that a moral God would withhold such contact? Would it not be cruel for him to create us for a reason and then not let us in on the secret, mess with our heads? A search for meaning apart from some type of religion leads only to the dead end of despair. A loving God would not delight in such emptiness. If meaning and value are found only in the Creator, he would be most cold not to share this meaning and value. We must conclude that a loving God reveals himself. Our next question deals with the specifics of his revelation. Naturally, we cannot place limitations on God's mode or style. We should rid ourselves of ultimatums like, well, if God has something to say to me, let him contact me at exactly 2 a.m. He must appear on my living room TV screen, and he must look like George Burns. Is God obligated to accommodate our peculiar expectations? Not at all. God can communicate any way he chooses. It may be with an audible voice, but he could also use telepathy, dreams, visions, prophets, feelings, all of the above or none of the above. Remember, we are not inventing the rules. We would also assume that if the Creator is revealing himself to people, he has always been revealing himself to people, for this too would be the only consistent act of love. I'm quite suspicious of the lone prophet who claims to be the first person to ever encounter God. Such partiality would be quite unfair to the billions who have been around since the beginning of time. With all due respect, we have just eliminated most religions for consideration by disregarding all new ones. Only ancient religions are still in the running, provided they give claim to revelation as far back as human history can be traced. But there must be more than a claim. It makes sense that people would keep records of such divine activity. God's intervention generation after generation can hardly escape notice, for it would have influenced history in dramatic and powerful ways. A collection of 39 ancient manuscripts known as the Old Testament makes such a claim. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all adhere to the Old Testament. The scriptures of Hinduism and Native American traditions are examples, although not exclusive examples, of alternate divine claims that also point to antiquity. Now, since several religions claim antiquity, we must examine another key standard of a loving God's revelation: consistency. Even when admitting that religions do in fact teach opposite theologies, many stubbornly grasp the idea that somehow every one of them came from the same God. Why is it so easy to envision a creator who unveils contradictory information? Why must a belief in God be divorced from our God-given ability to think? Paradoxically, people are not afraid to put Christianity through the ringer. Its claims are confronted all the time, all the time. Once while doing an open forum at Fresno City College, I was asked about Mormonism. I mentioned that Mormonism claimed to go by the Bible, yet taught polytheism, which completely contradicts the Bible. Isaiah 43:10. A young lady raised her hand. She says, "What right do you have to stand here and scrutinize somebody else's religion?" I says, "Hold on. For the last 2 hours, you and your friends have been doing nothing but scrutinizing my religion. Doesn't the Bible contradict itself? How do we know Jesus rose from the dead? Why would a loving God send people to hell? And this has not bothered me. It has been very appropriate. You should challenge anyone who makes a truth claim, but it works both ways. I will ask these same questions of other religions." She nodded because her double standard became so obvious. Her earlier skeptical questions confirmed an honest, inward conviction that all beliefs, even religious ones, must be examined. We must test whether they contradict themselves, and we must test whether they contradict each other. Now, there isn't the time right now to give every major religion its rightful day in court, but some brief examples will at least illustrate the process. Some Hindus believe that God and creation are one and the same. The Bible, on the other hand, paints a major distinction between the creation and the creator. If one person says God made the tree, while another says actually God is the tree, we cannot possibly conclude that they are both correct, even though they each use a similar word, God. Of course, this leads us to no conclusion at all about the accuracy of Hinduism or Christianity. It is instead a conclusion about the fallacy of universalism, the belief that all religions are true. On the other hand, Hinduism makes no claims to historical verification, and this is a significant thing to note. There are also contradictions between religions which accept the Bible. Islam claims that in addition to the Quran, both the Old and New Testament are the word of God. Well, Jesus is described in the Quran as a holy prophet, but not an incarnation of God himself. The test for a prophet in the Old Testament is that he must be accurate in everything he teaches. Deuteronomy 18. Jesus taught that he was God. If Jesus was lying, he was not a prophet. But Islam claims he was a prophet. If Jesus was telling the truth, then he is God. But Islam claims he wasn't God. Either way, we have a rather serious contradiction. Judaism teaches that the old covenant will be changed after the Messiah comes. Daniel 9 actually computes that time by measuring the amount in Hebrew years of 30 days each. He starts with the return of the Jews from Persian exile when King Artaxerxes freed the Jewish slaves, and ends with Messiah's arrival. This day occurred on Nisan 10, according to the Persian calendar, or March 30, 33 AD, according to the Julian calendar. Only one potential Messiah rode into Jerusalem that day, Jesus of Nazareth. If he was the Messiah, then Judaism's new covenant, Christianity, is now in force. If he wasn't the Messiah, then Daniel was a false prophet, but Judaism considers Daniel to be a true prophet. We have found a contradiction with Judaism as well. Now, I must be making myself very unpopular at this moment. Please understand, I do respect the many Muslims, Hindus, Jews, Mormons, Universalists, and others. I have met many honest, dedicated people of other religions, but this does not keep me from examining their claims, and we'll continue to examine such claims when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
How many times have you heard the phrase, "they're all the same," applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home, or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Jim Bell, said, "When people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt." For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
I'd like to remind all of my listeners that the Bob Siegel Show has a sister program on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on the dial. Every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30, you can hear City Voice, On this provocative program, my good friend George Runyon interviews a different local Christian ministry every week. You can listen to the show while driving to church, and don't be surprised, you may find it so interesting that you'll stay in the parking lot continuing to listen and skipping those Sunday school donuts. That's City Voice with George Runyon every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30 on our sister station, KPRZ 1210. But right now, you're listening to KCBQ 1170. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our program will be on next week. It's Easter Sunday, so people always wonder, are we going to be on? We will be on. We'll be having kind of a repeat broadcast, not all repeat. You'll hear my voice saying some new things, but it'll be a pre-recorded voice strung together by a lot of clips. So it's going to be kind of a best-of show. We're going to play some of the favorite satirical sketches that we've done over the years and some choice phone calls. I'm going to be taking the day off to spend time with my family. So the Bob Siegel Show will be on Easter. It'll be the best of the Bob Siegel Show. I know you hear that a lot, these best-of shows, the best of Prager, the best of Medved. I don't do it very often. I hardly ever do it. But I am going to do it next week. What do you think about that? We're talking about the consistency of religions, and I showed the inconsistency of some, consistency being one of the things we would expect from a loving God. He'd be consistent. He would not confuse us. So you're wondering, is Christianity any more consistent? It seems there are many contradictions to the Bible. Yes, it does seem that way. We must remember that the Bible was written in other languages by cultures far removed from ours. Most alleged contradictions stem from a misunderstanding of certain terms and phrases. For example, Jesus predicted that he would be in the grave for 3 days and three nights, Matthew 12. When we read the Passion narratives, we see that he was crucified late Friday afternoon, that he rose from the dead early on Sunday morning. It is, of course, impossible to get 3 days and three nights out of this, and I've seen many atheists refer to Jesus' prophecy as a blatant error, which completely destroys the credibility of the Bible. Well, the solution comes with an understanding of the way ancient Jews spoke. This is very important. To a Jew, any part of a day was viewed as a whole day. Describing part of a day as a day and a night may seem foreign to us, but that's because we live 2,000 years later in a completely different culture. We must realize that if the Bible did not contradict itself to the original audience it was written for, it cannot contradict itself to us. This is only one example of the many apparent Bible contradictions that melt away in light of authentic historical interpretation. And you think, but the Old and New Testament are very different. Isn't that a contradiction too? No, because again, the Old Testament predicts the New. The consistency we expect is not in the quantity of information, but in the accuracy of the facts. For example, Susan has a vision in which God says, "I love corporate worship." How do you like that? You like my impression of God? I love corporate worship. He sounds exactly like that. And Ron has a vision in which God says, I love private worship. Now, it's possible that both parties received an authentic vision. God may like both. He may like private and corporate worship. But supposing Susan heard God say, I hate corporate worship. Well, Ron heard, I love corporate worship. Now somebody is on the wrong frequency. At least one person did not have a true encounter. After all, God is not schizophrenic. Likewise, if God had warned the Hebrews to never expect another covenant from him, then any prophet who claimed to institute a new agreement between God and men could be immediately labeled as false. But instead, God said through Jeremiah, "Behold, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their forefathers." So you're wondering, well, if there's only one God who reveals himself, how come we have differences in people's beliefs? Well, a loving God would be a gentleman. He would not force himself upon those who don't want him, but would instead speak to those who are seeking. Most people accept the religion they are brought up in without question. Others, when choosing a religion, choose the one they like or the one that's convenient. Sometimes, like sheep, They are mesmerized by talented orators who speak with charisma and authority. We only have to recall the 900 unfortunate individuals who followed Jim Jones into the wilderness to remember that most become religious simply to have their needs and feelings satiated. Seldom do they say, I will examine the evidence to see which, if any, of these religions is actually true. We would also expect some religious teachings concerning life after death from a loving God who's revealing himself. The person who claims that death is final has a hard time supporting his remark. If death were final, God would be cruel. Let me say that again. If death were final, God would be cruel. Of course he would be cruel. I say this for the simple reason that all people cherish a pleasant, enjoyable life. Who could ever wish for such contentment to end? It would have been less evil for God to abort his plan of creation than to put us here with a love for life and then pull the plug, consigning us to oblivion without ever again having even a conscious thought. I know some people are glad to die. Suffering in the world makes life miserable. Granted, but these people would have preferred to not suffer. They would have preferred a fulfilling life. Otherwise, they would not view suffering as tragic. If they view suffering as tragic, it's because they don't want to suffer, which means they want a happy life. Even the person who commits suicide will do so because of depression or some tragedy he couldn't cope with. A tired, weak, sick old woman or man might prefer death over their condition, but if it were possible, they would much rather be rejuvenated to experience once again the health and energy of their youth. The fact that we even die at all is certainly a mystery, along with the origin of evil, but apparently people were not meant to die. Death is a slap in the face, a final disaster. A loving father will provide some kind of solution for our sick world, a remedy that overcomes death. All forms of evil must someday be destroyed. What is only a hope to us is a future certainty to God. So you're thinking, this doesn't prove the Christian belief in resurrections. There are other ideas about life after death, like reincarnation, for instance. Let me tell you about reincarnation. If somebody had to say it, it may as well be me. Reincarnation offers no hope from any practical perspective. If I am a reincarnated soul, I am completely unaware of it, completely unaware of my other lives. This means that should I die and come back again, my future identity will be without a knowledge of this life. As Bob Segal, I perceive my present state as all that I know and love. If this should end, how can I receive consolation? My future existence as a new man or woman who does not remember having been Bob Segal will be, for all intents and purposes, another person. How does this hope compare to the promise of living for all eternity as the same person? The probability of reincarnation becomes highly questionable, especially in relationship to a caring creator. You're thinking, well, but maybe there's another reason for reincarnation, a reason that's more important than our ability to remember. Maybe people are continually changing for the better each time they return. Yeah, that sounds good. Our species has had a long time to evolve, a long time. Show me the improvement. People are just as horrid and corrupt now as they were 10,000 years ago. As mentioned earlier, some of the worst atrocities were committed in the 20th century. According to the suggestion of reincarnation, we have each completed thousands of lives. When will there be something to show for it? You're thinking, yeah, but some people claim to remember their past identities. Yeah, some people claim to have received 3 magic wishes from a genie too. A rational improbability does not instantly change simply because of a claimed experience. Projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.osomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Oso Miller Pacific. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. What would a loving God do? How can we know which religion is correct by seeing which one shows the loving God? But we had certain expectations, certain things a loving God would do, certain things a loving God would not do. Now it's time to tie up the loose ends. What exactly did we say we were looking for? An ancient religion with historical claims to consistent revelation from God. This loving God is both just and merciful. He will offer a deliverance from sin to those who crave such freedom. People who are content in their sin will still be held accountable. Along with this salvation, God will provide an explanation for evil in the world apart from his own activity. Finally, God will offer everlasting life in a paradise society free from corruption. In other words, we are looking for a God who shares the gospel. We are looking for the God of the Bible. Now, when I was comparing the other religions and talking about Judaism, I discussed the Daniel 9 calendar. I'd like to look at that in a little bit more detail. Actually, it needs a lot more detail, far more detail than the few minutes of our program have left. So I'm going to be starting a conversation, which I'm not going to be able to conclude. And normally I would conclude it next week. But as I said, next week we're going to have a best of with repeat clips for our Easter broadcast. But I'll tell you what, if this satiates or initiates your curiosity, if you wanted to satiate your curiosity, I should say, go to my website, bobsiegel.net, bobsiegel.net. On the front page, there's a link under the section that says blogs that says questions and concerns about Christianity. Click on the questions and concerns about Christianity. You'll see many articles listed. One of them refers to the Daniel 9 calendar. And there you can read in its entirety what I'm about to start talking about now, because this is going to leave you hanging. Always leave them wanting more. One of the most interesting and conclusive prophecies about Jesus Christ comes to us from the prophet Daniel. A prisoner of the Babylonians first, and then the Persians when they conquered Babylon, Daniel found himself in the service of several kings. During this time, he received a variety of visions from God, including one on the future of his people, the Jews. I'm reading from Daniel 9, 24 through 27. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, by the way, means Messiah or Christ. So they're actually telling us, they're giving us a calendar of when the Christ will come. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. That's 69 sevens altogether for you math majors. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, or after the 69 weeks of years, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for one seven, but in the middle of that seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And one who causes desolation will place abominations on a wing of the temple until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Now you're going, what the heck does all that mean? Well, it's loaded. There are a bunch of predictions. Prediction one, the Jews will be granted permission to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That happened under Artaxerxes in 444 BC. Prediction two, 480 years after the decree, that's the 69 times 7 years, the Christ will make himself known to Israel. That happened in 33 AD. Prediction 3, a prediction that the Christ will be killed or cut off. See Isaiah 53:8, which clearly defines the phrase cut off as killed. Prediction 4, a prediction that the city of Jerusalem and the temple will be destroyed. That happened in 70 AD from Prince Titus and the Roman Legion. Prediction 5, a prediction of a postponed period of time, the last 7, in which the beast or a son of perdition or Antichrist, as we commonly call him, will invade a future temple for 3.5 years. You can read about this. This is the only one of these events that hasn't happened yet. But you can read about it happening in more detail in 2 Thessalonians 2, Revelation 13, Matthew 24, Daniel 11, and Daniel 12. Now let's do some definitions. A week or 7 in Hebrew thought referred to any period of 7. For instance, 7 days, 7 months, or possibly 7 words. The word Shabuah was used earlier by Daniel in chapter 10, where the phrase reads 3 units of 7 days. Daniel evidently added the word days to let his readers know which type of 7 he was referring to, and we would assume that the word days might have been added in chapter 9, if that is what Daniel meant. Most likely he assumed the periods of 7 years were understood by his readers if this prophecy is worked out with weeks of days, weeks of months, or even weeks of weeks. It is a false, unfulfilled prophecy, but with weeks of years, it works out by an amazing coincidence to the very day Jesus rode into Jerusalem. This fact, along with the acceptable possibility of the reference to years, settles the question. Now, what kind of years? The years that Daniel referred to, since he was a Hebrew, were Hebrew years, 12 months of 30 days each. This was the length in Genesis chapter 7. This was the length in Genesis chapter 8. John in the New Testament, speaking of the last half of the last week, makes use of the figure 1,260 days. This phrase is also found in Revelation 11, along with the term 42 months. So the 42 months equal 1,260 days, which equals a half week in Daniel 9, and the time times and a half time in Daniel 12, which we already established as being a cross-reference to the abomination of desolation. That's a lot. That's a mouthful. You know I don't usually like to pour a bunch of information on you like that. But again, if you look at the internet version of this, if you look at the literary version of this, and get a chance to look at it and study it in front of you, it's not going to look nearly as confusing. Now, some of the history of Egypt, India, Assyria, Babylon, and Greece use this type of calendar as well. What about this decree? The only decree that works out is one which is acceptable, for it certainly gave the Jews permission to return to their land and rebuild their city. Permission had already been given to rebuild the sanctuary. The decree is spoken of in Nehemiah 2, 1 through 8. The decree was on Nisan 1 of the Persian calendar, or March 5th, 444 BC of the Julian calendar. To calculate this calendar, we'd have to know the day and the year of Christ's death. In my article on the internet, I tell you how we can know for sure the day and year of Christ's death. Facts supporting such a date then will be offered later on. But for now, just take my word for it. For the sake of continuity, let me just show you how this calendar works with certain days. Assume. We assume that Christ rode into Jerusalem Monday, March 30th, 33 AD. Thursday evening, Jesus' Passover is still the beginning of Friday because the Jews started in the evening. 5 days before Friday is Monday. We see John 12:1, 6 days before the Passover, and John 12:12, the next day, the day of entry into Jerusalem. Daniel says that from the decree to the coming of Christ, 69 times 7 or 483 Hebrew years would pass. This means 12 months of 30 days each or 360 days to a year. 483 times 360 comes to 173,880 days. Hope you have your calculators in front of you. So Daniel is predicting 173,880 days from the decree of Artaxerxes to the coming of Christ. Now, Jewish years may be different, but days are days. To see if this works out, we will have to count according to the Julian year and see if we come to the same amount of days. From 444 BC to 33 AD is 476 years. Going March to March, 444 plus 33 is 477, but 1 BC to 1 AD is 1 year, not 2, so we subtract 1 year from 477. In other words, 444 years have passed at 1 AD, The 33 count starts from 1 AD to 2 AD. 1 AD to 2 AD is 1 year, so we count the first of the 33 years at 2 AD. For at 2 AD, the first of the 33 years has passed. This count gives us 32 years, so 444 plus 32 takes us to the end of 32 AD. At 33 AD, March, 33 years have passed. The 33rd year is the beginning. I know it sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook. Read the article, study it more carefully. It really is a fascinating prophecy. People are always asking for detail. They're always asking for something where with a calculator you could prove God. Well, you really can. Look at this article. And I will see you 2 weeks from now for a live show, the Best of Easter show next week. See you then.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.
Hello.